So we're thinking about a poem that was written nearly 3,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago. What on earth could a poem from 3,000 years ago still have to teach us today? And in fact, we're not just looking at a poem that was written 3,000 years ago. We're taking 5 weeks to work our way through it. Here's the whole poem. Let's just have the whole poem up. I'm not expecting you to be able to read this. But I want to show you how it works. There are 5 main chunks in this poem. And it's a poem that is all about one figure. It all zeroes in on one hero. And this poem says that this individual is the one that you can pin your hope on. Remember that ridiculous game that we sometimes played at children's parties where you pin the tail on the donkey, right? What a ridiculous game. Not a real donkey. If you've never played it, it's not a real donkey, although that would be more fun. It's a paper donkey that you put on the wall. It hasn't got a tail. You have a tail. You blindfold it, you try and pin it. Ridiculous. But here's the question. What are you pinning your hope on today? Or more carefully, who are you pinning your hope on? I think probably in our culture, the most obvious person that people choose to pin their hope on is themselves. That's largely what we're told. The best hope that we've got for this world is us. But this book of Isaiah, written nearly 3,000 years ago, this poem says, no, there's a better hope than you. There's a better hope for this world. There's a better hero, a better individual. Oh, let's call him a Messiah. And we began this poem last week, and in the first chunk, we saw we were introduced to the Lord's servant. See, my servant will act wisely. We met this servant, the one who's high and lifted up, the one who is God himself, and yet who came down so low. But we're now going to move to the second section. We're going to move to this second block, and you'll see this poem, each section gets a little bit longer, and it intensifies as this description of this figure, this hero, this Messiah is unpacked. So over the next 5 weeks, building up to the great crescendo on Easter Sunday, this poem is going to introduce you to the hope of the world, the Messiah. But before we read this next section that we're going to think about today, I want to start with a quote, not from the Bible, but from someone else. It was by a philosopher called Dostoevsky. And he said this, beauty will save the world. Beauty will save the world. Isn't that an interesting quote? I don't know, maybe you don't think it is. What do you reckon? Do you think that's true? There is something in humanity that is created with a capacity and a desire for beauty. We love beauty. We aspire to beauty. And certainly this writer from a couple of hundred years ago reckoned that it was unlocking that beauty that would save the world. And I'm going to try and show you this afternoon that he's sort of right and sort of wrong. It just depends what beauty you're talking about. So with all that in your heads, let's zoom in and make it slightly larger, the section that we're going to think about today. Here it is. Here is this next part of the poem introducing us to this one, the one. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. We're going to work through these three verses from this poem. Just try and think, what does it mean? What's it saying? I'm not trying to be clever. I don't want to try and impress you. I just want to try and show you what this poem says and say, what do you reckon? Does this ring true for you? Could it be that this one that's described in Isaiah 53 really is the hope of the world? So we're going to work through it like this. Let's just go. We're going to think firstly about this opening sentence. And I wonder if you can hear that the poet is a bit frustrated. Who's believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? What's he frustrated about? He's frustrated because he says, people aren't getting it. Now, let's just think about this phrase, the arm of the Lord. That's a bit weird, right? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Well, in the Bible, the arm of the Lord has a very specific meaning. Here's some words from Psalm 98. Psalm 98, verse 1 says this. Sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him. The Lord's holy arm has worked salvation. My arms are able to do some things. I can do some things with my arms. And some of us are quite pleased with our arms, aren't we? Some of us like to show our arms to one another and to ourselves often. The idea of a strong arm is seen as a good thing. I remember the day that I beat David Murphy in an arm wrestling competition at school. You're not impressed. He was an enormous bloke, huge. Beat him. The strength of the arm is a picture, and particularly in the Bible, it's the right arm of God. It's the strength of him, but particularly it's God's strength. It's his power to save people. His right arm is the arm that saves. And so God comes to his people when they're slaves in Egypt, and his arm, his right arm, saves them. And through the book of Isaiah, we saw last week that this world needs saving. This world is a place of darkness and a place of death. It's a place where God's judgment hangs over this world because of our rebellion and sin. And this poem says that God's arm is ready to save people. But you can tell in this poem that people don't seem to be listening. Who's believed our message? I don't know if you've ever had the experience of trying to explain to someone, trying to bring a message to someone, and they don't believe you. You got good news. You got something to share. And people say, oh, shut up, that's not true. And it's so frustrating. And Isaiah, this prophet, as he writes his poem, he says, no one's believing it. I come with a message of salvation. I come with a message of this hero, this one who is the power of God's arm to save people, and no one believes it. So here's the question. Why? Why don't people recognize the Messiah? It was true when Isaiah was writing his prophecy, and it's true today that many, many people around our world do not recognize that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. He is the hero. He is the center point of human history. He is the Messiah. So why don't people believe it? Why would people reject it? Why can't people see that in Jesus there is the power to save? If you're a Christian here and you do believe that Jesus is the Messiah, you must have felt this. Why don't other people see it? You ever felt like that? Why don't people get it? And if you're here and you're still working out what you believe, you may say, well, I just can't see it. I can't see why Jesus is the Messiah. It doesn't make any sense to me. All right, let's listen to the next bit of the poem. Because this poem gives us two big reasons why people don't recognize that Jesus is the Messiah. Here are the two big reasons. I'll tell you what the two reasons are, then we'll look at them in detail. The first reason is, he doesn't have what we desire. And the second reason is, he does have what we despise. And that's why we don't recognize him. Okay, we'll come back to all that. So let's look at this next bit of the poem. We're just going to work through it. He does not have what we desire. Listen to these words and see if you can hear it for yourself. He, that's this servant of the Lord, this Messiah, this hero, the hope of the world, he grew up before him, that's God, before God, like a tender shoot and like a root of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. What does Jesus not have that we love? Well, a couple of things. You see it? For a start, he doesn't have status. He grew up like a tender shoot and a root out of dry ground. He doesn't have status, and we as human beings love status. We love someone who looks impressive and important, and Jesus was a little shoot. Now, first you may read that and say, oh, that's quite sweet. Jesus grew up like a little shoot. Oh, cute little shoot. No, it's more like a weed, right? It's the sort of thing that you would just ignore. You're out for a walk in the forests, and you're just trampling on these little shoots everywhere, right? Like a hooligan destroying the world. Here we are, out for a walk. That's why I don't like walking. Or concrete. Concrete's okay. And here I am. And these little shoots, there's shoots everywhere, and they mean nothing. You just, they have nothing. They're not impressive in any way. Or a root out of dry ground. A little bit of root that you trip over. I guarantee you've never really been on a walk and stopped going, oh, look, it's a tiny little shoot or a little root. These are things that are inconsequential. They don't matter. Coming up out of dry ground, there's nothing there. It all looks so unimpressive. So let's think about Jesus. Jesus was born in a nowhere place called Nazareth. Jesus was born to nobody parents. They weren't famous. I mean, obviously, they're quite famous now. But at the time, do you know, at the time, Mary, right? Mary, she's quite famous now. Mary, the mother of Jesus. 20% of girls at that time were called Mary. She didn't even have an ordinary, she was a very ordinary name. And so here is this Nazareth, this nowhere place, and this little baby born to nobody parents, like a little shoot that you could so easily miss. He's not impressive. He didn't come from an important family. That wasn't his origin. He didn't come from an important place, and he wasn't friends with important people. In fact, he hung around with fishermen. Fishermen who were nobodies. And he didn't go to an impressive university. In fact, he didn't even go to university. You see, here is this unimpressive, low-status person. And God says, by the way, when the Messiah comes, he will be a little shoot, a little dry root that you could miss so easily. You could just trample on it when you're out for a walk in the woods. And so here is the problem, right? Because actually my heart loves status. I love what's important, don't you? I'm kind of wowed by people who have a bit of power. I'm wowed by people who have impressive family. If someone were to come into church today and they said, oh yeah, my mum and dad kind of run a multi-billion dollar business, it'd be hard not to, a little part of you go, oh yeah, I'll get to know you. Because that's not a little shoot. They're like a, ooh, they look quite strong tree. And that's something in us that wants that. And so here comes the Messiah, and he's a nobody from nowhere. And I don't really want to be a nobody. I don't want to associate with nobodies. And so the world rejected the Messiah because he just wasn't impressive enough. He didn't have a high enough status. But not only did he not have status, notice he also didn't have beauty. He had no beauty. Now, what are we supposed to do with that? He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He had no beauty. Now, let's be careful. I don't think this means that he was like hideously ugly. I don't think this means that when he was born as a baby, everyone, oh, what an ugly child. Apart from the fact that most babies are ugly. But, sorry, unpopular opinion. They grow up, that's nice, it's fine. Doesn't matter, cute, all right, fine. I think, now I'm in trouble. I think that it's not that. What it means is that there was not anything about his appearance that you would have been attracted to and gone, wow, look at him. Now, human beings love beauty. We love beauty. And the reason we love beauty is because we were created by a God who is beautiful. He made a beautiful world. And this beautiful God made a beautiful world for us to enjoy. So is beauty a good thing?
Yes.
Thanks for joining in. Yes. Beauty is a good thing. But here's what happens. Human beings have an amazing ability to take good things, to distort them, and to make them enslaving things. And so it is quite possible, and in fact, it is absolutely now the natural instinct of the human heart to be enslaved by a desire for beauty. Look at this famous, this is a very famous painting. Some of you will know this painting, right? Who's this? This is Narcissus, right? This is painted by Caravaggio. This is Narcissus. The story goes that, I mean, it's a long story. It's got more complexities than this. But basically, he saw his reflection in the water and fell in love. And he fell in love with his own reflection, with his own beauty, and was completely captivated by his beauty. I think it's a very insightful story about what we're like as human beings. If you want a slightly less highbrow, this is the magic mirror from Snow White. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? The question that has haunted humanity, right? Who's the fairest? Who's the most beautiful? Is it me? And this is why we stand in front of mirrors and we gaze. And we spend hours and we spend thousands and millions of pounds. Because we want beauty. We crave beauty. We crave an external beauty. And the tragedy is that it's our culture that gets to tell you what the beauty is that you should crave. So we are manipulated and enslaved by a media and a culture that tells you what you have to be, then when you don't match up, makes you feel rubbish, and then tells you this is how you can spend lots of money to try and get there. You see, there is a slavery around beauty. And this is why Dostoevsky is not entirely right. Beauty, that sort of beauty, will destroy the world. This is a beauty that will hold us in its spell. You see, beauty is a gift from God. And we enjoy that beauty, but then we're enchanted by that beauty, and then we're enslaved by that beauty, and then we're destroyed by that beauty. And I just want to take this opportunity to say to us as a church, and for some of us in this room, this is a huge issue, right? We feel like we don't measure up. We feel like we're not beautiful. We feel like, for whatever reason, that we're not making this mark that people want. And we feel, therefore, somehow our worth is less. And in many ways, our world treats us like that. Beautiful people have a commodity that they can weaponize and use in order to gain power and to gain wealth and to gain positions. Beauty is a powerful commodity in our world. So I want to say to us, this Messiah who came into the world had no beauty. That was not his currency. He did not come into this world in order to weaponize an outward form of beauty, in order to establish himself as the greatest and the most superior, so that he could gain glory. In fact, he deliberately chose to reject all of that and to take a form, to take a human form that had no physical beauty. That you would have walked past in the street and not turned your head. I love this, right? I absolutely love this. Jesus is the eternal Son of God, the high and lifted up one who came down as a human being, and he's walking through the market and people are selling him fish and bumping shoulders with him. It's like crazy. And they don't even notice. Because this hope of the world is not a hope that will feed your desire and your enslavement to beauty. This is not a hope like that. This is a hope that will set you free from that slavery. Have a look at these words from later on in the Bible. And actually, slightly earlier. This is how God treats you. Do not consider that they're trying to choose who should be king of Israel, right? Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. You see, the way that God will save the world is not through human beauty, but it is through beauty. It is through the beauty of a heart that is rightly worshiping and loving God. It is that beauty that God will use to save the world. Our human obsession and enslavement with beauty has led to such pain and devastation. It has led to so much anguish and sorrow and tears. Our human obsession with beauty has led us to slavery. Jesus comes and he says, I want to set you free. I want to set you free by showing you that there is a beauty which is far deeper, richer, and more powerful than the outward form of beauty that you settle for. So why do people not recognize that Jesus is the Messiah? Because he's not beautiful enough. He just isn't. Until you see his heart. Until you see the way that he served the poor. Until you see the way that he wept with the sinner. Until you see the way that he cared for the prostitute and for the downcast and the broken. And then you say, well, perhaps no, there is beauty here. But not a beauty that will ever impress the world. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. I wonder this afternoon, perhaps Jesus wants to set our hearts free from a love of beauty, a love of outward beauty, and replace it with a deep desire for an inner beauty. Just a story to lighten the mood for a moment. I have three sons, as some of you will know. My eldest son, when he was very young, had a Thomas the Tank Engine jumper, which he loved very dearly. And one day, some friends of ours came around, and he went running up to this lady and said, do you like my jumper? Do you like my jumper? Now, she was very concerned about children taking pride in their outward appearance and was very like... So she said to him, very wisely, it's a lovely jumper, but it's what's on the inside that really matters. And he went, I've got Bob the Builder! Anyway, doesn't matter. Inward beauty. So here is Jesus. He does not have what we desire. We desire status, we desire beauty. Jesus does not come with either. He lets go of status, he lets go of outward beauty in order to embrace the low place of sacrifice and in order to be truly beautiful. But now let's just flip it around. Not only does he not have what we desire, he also has what we despise. So listen to verse 3. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised and we held him in low esteem. Why don't people see that Jesus is the Messiah? Well, just look at him. He was despised. I don't want to be despised. So I desire status and beauty, and I despise suffering and shame. And Jesus is that Messiah. So we're told he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Jesus suffered. And not just a little bit, he was familiar with pain. Familiar with it. He wasn't a passing acquaintance. It wasn't a nod of the head as you go past someone in the street that said, oh, hello, nice to see you. He didn't nod his head at suffering as it kind of passed by him at a distance. He was familiar with it. He entered into the intimacy of suffering. He knows what it's like. He has experienced suffering. Now, honestly, this is massive stuff. Remember, this is God, the high and lifted up one, the one who is eternal. The God who cannot suffer, suffers. He comes into our suffering. He left the glory of heaven, took human nature, became a man of sorrows. He knows what it's like to cry. He knows what it's like to feel pain. He knows what it's like to be disappointed. He knows what it's like to be betrayed. He knows what it's like to be let down by his friends. He knows what it's like to be spat on and lied about. He knows it. He knows it all. One of the great objections to Christianity, and maybe you're not a Christian here and you say, I've got a big objection. My objection is, why is there so much suffering in the world? If there is a good God, why doesn't he remove all suffering? This is the answer. The answer is not, here is a God who can explain your suffering. The answer is, here is a God who will come into your suffering. Here is the God who will come and be with you in your suffering. This is far more profound than some philosophical debate. He doesn't sit and say, oh, let's have a discussion about suffering. He comes into your suffering, into your pain. He knows what it's like. So if you know what it's like to suffer, you have to know that this Messiah, this hope of the world, this hero, this one, he suffered. He's familiar with suffering. He knows what you feel. He understands your pain. He's entered into it. And in a remarkable way, it is through Jesus that your suffering is redeemed. It is through Jesus that your suffering is turned from being a wasted, pointless nothing to become, in his hands, the means by which he brings true beauty. You're going to have to wait for next week to see how Jesus takes the suffering, even the suffering of the cross, and unleashes in an just extraordinary way how he twists and unleashes all of God's grace through the suffering so that you might find true comfort. So here he is, the one who suffers and the one who is ashamed. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised and we held him in low esteem. I hate being ashamed. I hate being made to feel small. I hate it when people laugh at me, don't you? And yet here is Jesus, the Messiah, who was despised and held in low esteem. I want status. I want people to be impressed. I want applause. Jesus got mockery. The Messiah who was mocked. So now you go back to our original question. Why don't people recognize the Messiah? Well, because they're laughing at him. Because he's suffering and he's shamed. So where does all this stand? Let's land all this. You're going to have to come. Look, I'm really sorry, but you're going to have to come back next week. Because next week is where this... I'm not going to steal James's thunder from next week, because next week is where you begin to see how all of this was God's plan. This is how God saves the world. It is through suffering and through shame that God saves the world. It is through the suffering and shame of Jesus that God saves you. But just for today, I want to point you to Jesus, and I want to say to you, he is the Messiah. And if you can have the eyes to see past the status and beauty that our world holds out to you, you will find a deeper beauty and a greater status in Christ than you will anywhere else. And if you can lift your eyes from the suffering and the shame that you experience in this world, and you can see Jesus as the one who does not despise your suffering, but instead shares your suffering, you will find in him the one who can make you right again. So this afternoon, I wonder, as we hear this message of this Messiah, are we ready to say, I turn my back on status. I turn my back on beauty. Those are not the things that are going to define me. I want this Jesus to define me. And I want to be defined by the inner beauty of a heart that worships. And in your suffering and your shame, are you not going to hate those, but instead run to Jesus and find in Jesus the one who redeems your suffering and your shame in order that you might find life in him? This poem's amazing, right? And this poem is here to lead us to worship Jesus. So we're going to do that. We're going to worship the one who came for us. So let me lead us in prayer, and then we're going to share bread and wine together. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that it is in this Jesus Christ, this Messiah, that we see your powerful arm to save. Thank you that at the cross, as Jesus died, you stretched out your powerful arm to destroy death, to forgive sin, and to bring people from darkness to light. Father, we pray this afternoon, stretch out your powerful hand. Lord, in this room, Lord, some of us, we've never accepted Jesus. We've never seen him. We've never understood it. We've never believed this message. This afternoon, help us to believe. Help us to take hold of Jesus by faith. Help us to find in him hope and life and joy. Father, for many of us in this room, help us to see Christ again. Help us to see him more clearly. Father, forgive our hearts that so chase after the status and beauty of this world. And let us instead esteem Jesus. Let us hold him in high esteem this afternoon as we worship him together. Amen.